Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you that the following podcast was produced for the Southern Labor Studies Association. You can visit the SLSA online at southernlaborstudies.org, and you can follow the SLSA on Twitter at SouthernLaborSA. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Welcome to Working History, a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today I'm speaking with Karen Cox, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She is the author or editor of several books, including Dixie's Daughters, The United Daughters of the Confederacy, and The Preservation of Confederate Culture, and most recently, Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Karen Cox, welcome to Working History.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Your most recent book, Goat Castle, looks at the events surrounding the murder of Jane Merrill, known to most as Jenny, in Natchez, Mississippi, on the night of August 4th, 1932. To start us off, can you briefly discuss what took place that night?
Sure. A number of the principals that are in this story had plotted basically to rob Jenny Merrill. They were both white and black Natchezians. It's in the depths of the Depression. They assumed Jenny Merrill had money, which she did. She just didn't keep it at home. And so the robbery went bad, and she was probably put up a fight and ended up losing her life as a result. She was shot and killed in her home in this botched robbery. And then things just begin to unravel after that.
In the book, you introduce a number of principals: Jenny Merrill, Dick Dana, Octavia Dockery, Lawrence Williams, who has a number of aliases. He goes by Pinckney, Pink, George Pearls. We also have Emily Burns, Jenny's cousin Duncan Minor, the town of Natchez itself. To set the stage for us, can you talk about what Natchez was like? What was it like in its antebellum heyday, first of all? And then how had it changed by the time of Jenny Merrill's murder in 1932?
Natchez is really quite fascinating. It's a small town on the bluffs of the Mississippi River, about an hour south of Vicksburg, about an hour north of Baton Rouge. And in the antebellum period, Natchez was sort of one of the towns that was at the center of the cotton boom, the antebellum cotton boom that had a boom in the 1830s and again in the 1850s. And this led a lot of not just Southern planters to invest in land in that area in the lower Mississippi Valley, but also a lot of Northern investors. Men from New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, they headed to the Deep South to buy up a lot of the land, invest in that cotton. And so Natchez became, was at the center, too, of the domestic slave trade, because it was going to require a lot of slaves in order to produce that cotton. And so many of the nearly 1 million slaves, men, women, and children who were forced to migrate to the Deep South were sold in the town of Natchez and then put to work on plantations in Mississippi and Louisiana across the river where most of the plantations were, and essentially made millionaires out of these men. And so Natchez was known at the beginning of right before the Civil War as this town of millionaires, that there were more millionaires per capita in Natchez than in the entire United States. And then, of course, the Civil War came. It ended slavery. And in the decades that followed, Natchez changed quite a bit. Many of those planters left the area. Some stayed. You see the emergence of a Jewish mercantile class in Natchez. And then you move, you know, fast forward into the 20th century. Natchez is becoming, you know, less a notable town because the river traffic dries up. There's no, this makes it very, very hard to get to Natchez. There's no roads there. There's a train nearby, but that's about it. And then by 1932, we're in the depths of the Depression. And, you know, basically all Natchez has left is, you know, these buildings, these homes that were representative of their former glory. But Natchez was no longer that town that it had once been. And Jenny Merrill, who was a descendant of the planter class, that's, you know, partly why this story is made national headlines, was descended from the most elite of that original planter class. And then, you know, the African-Americans who are part of this case are the descendants of the slaves that worked those plantations.
So to pick up on this, then, in many ways, GoCastle does tell the story of the decline of the planter class in the decades following the Civil War. How do we see this through the characters, if you want to call them that, of Jenny Merrill, of Dick Dana, of Octavia Dockery, and even of GoCastle itself that really becomes its own spectacle?
Sure. Jenny Merrill and her cousin Duncan Miner were both descendants of great planter wealth. The two probably major families, not only in Natchez, but in the entire South. And they, over the course of several decades, they, you know, the family still had money. Even when her father lost everything, you know, lost slaves, he owned something like 600 slaves, which made him, you know, he was in the top 1%. And so, but even after he had lost all that, he had a home in New York. He moved to New York after the war, and he built a home in 1866 in Newport, Rhode Island. I mean, these people had money coming out their ears. And so, even though he had died in the interim, Jenny had inherited a lot of money. She still owned a lot of land. And so she was still okay by 1932, as was her cousin Duncan Miner. But on the other hand, her neighbors, Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery, were also descendants of Southern elites, and they had lost everything. Octavia in particular is interesting because her father was a planter in Arkansas, had lost everything during the Civil War, and he immediately went into great decline. He was one of those, he was a planter that had maybe 20, 25 slaves, which would have made him a wealthy man, but when he lost that, he had nothing else, whereas the Merrill family had diverse investments. And so they were going to be fine, whereas someone like Octavia Dockery's father, Thomas Dockery, he just lost everything and went into a steep decline. And so she was born in 1865, and she basically does not get to inherit, you know, the mantle of Southern Belle and the lady of, you know, the plantation, et cetera. And so she is... we'll find her in the, by the 1890s, already like boarding with her brother-in-law and her sister. And she ends up moving into the estate with Dick Dana. And Dick Dana is a descendant of the Danas of New England. He's related to ministers, but also a second cousin to Charles Dana, who the publisher of the New York Sun. I mean, he's also a descendant, but he's basically become mentally unstable, and he's not able to maintain his inheritance, which is Glenwood, the house that becomes known as Goat Castle. So you have this white pair on one side who still maintains some of the wealth, and then this pair on the other, which is Octavia Dockery and Dick Dana, who are unmarried, but who are living just basically to survive. They live together at the estate, who represent the complete, you know, loss of all that wealth by 1932.
And can you tell us why the house that Dana and Dockery lived in comes to be called Goat Castle?
Okay, so Glenwood was a really nice home. but by 1932, I mean, it was in complete rack and ruin. But Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery were still living in the home with a menagerie of animals, but they were known because they kept a pen of goats inside of the house, which had been, the room was, I think, the former dining room of the home. You have to understand, this was like a two-story house. It had a upper porch, a lower porch, had four chimneys. I mean, it was a, a typical antebellum mansion on the outskirts of Natchez, but it was crumbling down around them, and it was just absolute filth inside. We'll be get the nickname Goat Castle when this murder story goes nationwide.
And what can we learn about the economics of post-Civil War Natchez and the wider Jim Crow South through the stories of Lawrence Williams and Emily Burns, the two African-American principals in this story?
Lawrence Williams was about 20 years older than Emily. He was born in the 1870s. He grew up in that, time in Mississippi, which was really pretty awful for African Americans. I mean, there, whatever the Freedmen's Bureau tried to accomplish was, was being negated by former planters. We see, the rights of the convict lease system, just laws that were put into place that just, basically erased any kind of rights that they may have gained after the Civil War. And so Lawrence Williams grows up in that. And by World War I, he joins, other African-Americans in the Great Migration North, and he headed to Chicago, where he found a job in the Argo plant outside of Chicago in the area called Summit. He worked, that makes the cornstarch. And so he was there, that's where he had found a job, had married and was living before, the Depression hit, and he returned to Natchez to look for work. And it was, he came back to Natchez, and he went to Jenny Merrill's house, and he went to Duncan Miner, and he was trying to find work, and he was unable to find any work there. Emily, on the other hand, is born in 1890s. And so she's one of those African Americans whose family did not leave Natchez, did not migrate. And they stayed in the town of Natchez. Like a lot of African Americans after the Civil War, they left plantations and moved into towns. And they did that in Natchez as well. And so she grew up there. And like many Black women, their job opportunities were very limited to basically domestic work. And so while she did marry, she was a widow by 1930, and so was her mother. And so they lived together in a little shack in the Black neighborhood along St. Catherine Street, which was the Black business district in Natchez. Because of the Depression, she and her mother took in boarders, which is how she came to meet Lawrence Williams. He came to live in the house with she and her mother.
So on the night of Jenny Merrill's murder, Essentially, what happens is Dana and Dockery hatch a plan, if you will, to rob her house and enlist Williams, Lawrence Williams, to be part of this. Emily Burns gets caught up in the what turns into a robbery gone bad when she goes out for a walk with Williams. He ultimately will threaten her life, saying if she leaves or if she tells anyone, he will kill her. And so Emily stays outside Merrill's home while Dockery, Dana, and Williams presumably go inside. Shots are fired. Jenny is killed. And then they dispose of her body. Immediately following the murder and the discovery of Jenny Merrill's body, the investigation turns up lots of evidence. Arguably, the most damning pieces of evidence initially are the fingerprints that were found inside Merrill's home of Dick Dana, of Octavia Dockery, and then of a third person who is later discovered to be Lawrence Williams. Dana Dockery and then eventually Emily Burns and her mother, Nellie Black, are detained by local authorities. But here the story takes very different turns for the white principals, Dana and Dockery, and the African-American principals, Williams, Burns, and also Emily Burns's mother, Nellie Black. So let's start with Lawrence, quote unquote, Pink Williams, as Emily knows him, and Emily Burns. What happens with them? Conversely, what happens for Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery?
Okay, well, it's clear that Dana and Dockery and Emily and Pink are all at Merrill's house that evening. And so he leaves town. He heads back to Chicago and leaves his belongings behind at her house, but because he's got to get out of town quickly. And so he heads north. And within like 3 days after the murder of Jenny Merrill at her home, an attempted arrest of him in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, turns into his being shot and killed by the local police deputy who thinks he's resisting arrest, which is a very familiar story today. Right. And so he's now out of the picture. I mean, he can't be investigated, obviously, at this point. So that leaves Emily, and then and she will be and people, locals will kind of say, well, he was staying with her. And so they go arrest her and her mother and take her to jail. Of course, Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery are also in jail at this point because their fingerprints had been found inside the house. But within about 10 days, there's a lot of, you know, outcry in the local white community about these poor white people, about, you know, had fallen on hard times, but who are also, you know, descended from, you know, elites, which is, you know, a thing of value in a community like Natchez. So they're allowed to go home on their own recognizance while Emily and her mother remain in the local jail awaiting their fate.
And they're there for months, right?
Yeah, they're there for 4 months. And they are not allowed an attorney, whereas, you know, Dana and Dockery have attorneys volunteering for them. I mean, it's such a clear case of the double standard of justice, just from the beginning. There's like, you know, attorneys for white people, but no attorneys for the black people. There are people allowed to visit and interview Dana and Dockery about their lives. You know, nobody's allowed to come, you know, doing this for Emily and her mother. The only visitor that they're allowed is a minister. And that's because the local sheriff hopes that, you know, the minister will convince Emily to confess.
And she ultimately does give a quote unquote confession. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances of that?
Right. Well, she's being, you know, interviewed, you know, several hours a day. And it takes about 8 days, and she's not saying anything for all that time. And then one of the deputies, a person, a special deputy who had been deputized for this particular case, lays a bullwhip on the table and says, "You have 30 minutes to confess." And she will say at trial, "I said what I said basically because I did not want to be whipped." And that's just like so heartbreaking to me, to think about a person who essentially was just living a, you know, a normal life, and someone comes into her life that gets her involved in this terrible, you know, robbery gone bad. She didn't know. She was just going for a walk with him, Lawrence Williams, pink to her for the evening, and, you know, everything goes awry. And so it's just a sad thing, because she's, you know, she's stuck because he's, you know, she doesn't want to rat him out. She also is scared to death because all these white men are berating her around the, you know, these the table. And so she does confess, but under duress.
While all that is going on, you know, on the other side, as you said, Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery are out there being interviewed, and they start to make money, or try to start to make money off of their sort of 15 minutes of fame. So what's happening there on that side of it?
Natchez is an interesting place, because that spring before this murder, you know, it was the very first pilgrimage of Holmes, which was already drawing tourists and had, you know, Natchez was already kind of known. I mean, the New York Times had written articles about the Natchez pilgrimage, that, you know, Northerners and Midwesterners had been traveling there. So they were aware of where Natchez was. And so, but when this events came out, and the quirky nature of Goat Castle, you know, Dick Dana's odd behavior, in the story that was the media was generating, people started coming in to Natchez to see this place, even while Dana and Dockery were in jail. And so by the time they got out, they, through a group of advisors, decided that they were going to open, they were going to make money off their notoriety, including charging for, you know, to come onto the grounds, and then a second fee to enter the house. So they were making money on their notoriety in the months after they were, like 2 months after their release from jail. And they were still charged with murder. The grand jury hadn't even met yet. There was a good chance that they could have been indicted, but of course they weren't.
So Emily Burns ultimately will be the only person tried in court for the murder. Could you talk a little bit about how her murder trial played out, and also why the case against Dana and Dockery never ends up going to trial?
Well, I mean, her trial was very swift. It started on the Friday after Thanksgiving at like 8 in the morning. It had finished by noon on Saturday. And it's interesting, because it's like, you know, all the witnesses came forward and said, you know, many of the, you know, deputies. I mean, you just imagine you're this lone black woman in a courthouse filled with white people. And they're, you know, I mean, you probably know the outcome. The outcome is I'm going to be convicted and make, you know, guilty. The only thing she didn't know was whether or not she would get the death penalty. So it was very swift. I mean, the community wanted someone to pay. Lawrence Williams, who was the likely trigger man, he was already dead. So they needed someone to pay. And they wanted, you know, an African-American person. They weren't going, you know, despite evidence to the contrary, they weren't going to, you know, indict Dana Dockery. At least we don't think they are. And so, you know, it was very swift. She was convicted. She could have been given the death penalty, but she was given life in prison, because this is what was interesting to me. It's like even this jury of 12 white men could not bring themselves to give her the death penalty. And so as a result, she automatically got life in prison. And on December 5th, she was headed to Parchman Prison for a life sentence. And, you know, Dana and Dockery at this November grand jury, you know, the sheriff fully expected them to be indicted, but they never talked about the fingerprint evidence after it was so clear, you know, it all, it became all about the ballistic evidence. So, so they go home, they're not indicted, you know, and Emily goes to prison.
How do you see this isolated murder case, the Goat Castle case, shedding light onto the wider story and the wider injustices of the legal and criminal justice systems across the Jim Crow South?
I think it is that while the story is isolated, it is a unique story to Natchez. It fits into the broader, our broader threads of American history, whether that's the Jim Crow injustice that was, you know, could be found anywhere in the South at the time. And, you know, the town of Natchez and in the story of injustice, it's like, it's just an American story. I mean, there, you know, we learn through this story of Goat Castle, we learn about, you know, about the domestic slave trade. We learn about the decline of the planter aristocracy. We learn something about dark tourism. We learn about, you know, Jim Crow injustice. And to me, I also just noticed this sort of like this, if you know anything about Natchez, there's this line of poverty that extends from slavery to today. So there is this area of Natchez known as the Forks of the Road, and this is where the slave traders had their pens in the antebellum period. And that's where the ancestors of Emily were bought and sold, as were many of people living there. And there's this, again, I said there's this line of poverty starting there that goes into the present day. What's interesting about that is after the Civil War, Black neighborhoods were created around the former slave trading post, Forks of the Road. By 1932, Emily was living in one of these little shacks, which was literally a stone's throw from the Forks of the Road. So she's living, she could look and see the place where her ancestors were bought and sold. If you would fast forward to today, the little street which her home once sat on, the one she shared with her mother, is now, well, it was called Cedar Alley, and now it's called Cedar Homes, which is now federal housing. So there's this like long line of poverty and from which African Americans never escape in a town like Natchez because of their race. You know, while it is an isolated story, it, you know, as I say, you know, just as all politics is local, all history is local. There's so many stories that are truly American stories, but can be found in a small town like Natchez.
What ultimately happens to Emily Burns, Dick Dana, and Octavia Dockery?
Dana and Dockery will continue to live at Goat Castle, continue to collect receipts at Goat Castle. There will be attempts to evict them, and they will, you know, call in the press to save them. And they Dana will die in 1948, in October of 48. And Octavia Dockery will die in February of 49, after which the people had basically been squatters there because other people had paid the taxes on the property. So once that was over, the people who owned the property were like finally glad to get rid of the two of them. And they basically sold it. It was in Goat Castle. The house was razed. And then they had they built a mid-century modern housing development that's still there called Glenwood, after the name of the house. And then Emily returned to Natchez. She spent 8 years in prison at Parchman, which was it's just the worst place a person could have been in the sent in the 30s. And so but she survived that. Her sentence was suspended in 1940, in December 1940, you know, and she had gone to a mercy court. The governors of Mississippi offered these things called mercy courts. And she tried what before, but this governor, Paul Johnson, believed her and released her, and she was able to return to Natchez. And she lived there the rest of her life. Went back to her church, Antioch Baptist Church, where she became a mother of the church. And she died in 1969.
How has the GoCastle murder been remembered? And what does this tell us about history versus memory?
This was, for Natchez, its crime of the century. And so, because it garnered, you know, national attention, papers across the country were like covering the story throughout the fall of 1932. But once it was, you know, sort of wrapped up, and it would continue to be discussed in the next decade as, you know, in magazines and things like that. So America forgot it, but Natchez didn't forget. But the way in which it's been told and retold, all the focus is in, has been on Dana and Dockery, the home they lived in, Goat Castle. And that's pretty much it. I mean, they really don't, in some ways, Jenny Merrill's murder is sort of an afterthought. And Emily Burns was virtually erased from the story. If you were to say, well, who really killed Jenny Merrill? If you were to ask someone in Natchez, they wouldn't know. They wouldn't know. And she was the only one to be on trial, only one convicted, only one to serve prison time. Because it's been all about the just sort of the crazy of Goat Castle. And so I liken it to something like the kid, you know, memory as this thing that, you know, this game that children play where you sit in a circle and someone gives you says something in your ear and you pass it around. And by the time it gets back to the first person, you know, the story's completely changed. And that's how it is in Natchez. I mean, some parts are still are true, but a lot of it had been lost. And, you know, having been down there in November to share the book with the people of Natchez, I think they're all kind of surprised about, you know, the complete story and of what happened. And I certainly the family of Emily Burns is who I got to meet during my research. I'm sure is thankful for that.
What do you want most for your readers to take away from this book?
I guess it depends on the reader. I mean, I think it's a book that's a model for how to write, you know, good history. And I mean, I don't want to be like shy about this. I think it's well written, you know. I think it is. It's a good story. I mean, I think that's the thing that I think we can do as historians is tell good stories without sacrificing, you know, the sort of the kinds of things that we do as historian, all that.
The good scholarship part of it.
Yeah, the good scholarship is still there. It's just the way it's told. For, you know, general readers, I'd, you know, like for them to hopefully, you know, make the connections between, you know, the racial injustices of 100 years ago and the ones that still are here, you know, that and noticing that things haven't changed in that regard. You know, I think that also that back to what I said earlier about local stories have a lot to tell us about American history. And so I think that that's kind of what I would want people to get out of it.
Well, Karen Cox, Goat Castle is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed reading it. And so thank you for joining us and talking about it on this episode of Working History.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
Thanks again to Karen Cox, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She is the author of Goat Castle, a true story of murder, race, and the Gothic South, published by the University of North Carolina Press. And thank you for listening to this episode of Working History, produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.